Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Lion of Anjou by David Field, narrated by Nigel Patterson. 1. A wedding ceremony that was destined to shape the future of several nations was being conducted in secret. The chosen location was the Cathedral of St. Peter, Poitiers, whose construction had been instigated by the woman who was now standing before its high altar to take her second set of wedding vows. It was the 18th of May, 1152, and very few outside the immediate bridal party knew what was about to take place. The bride was Eleanor, Duchess of Aquitaine and Countess of Poitou in her own right. At 30 years of age, she was 11 years older than the groom, and she had until only 2 months previously been the Queen of France. The groom was destined to become King of England, and was already, thanks to his father's legacy, Duke of Normandy and Count of Anjou. He was Henry Plantagenet, the bride's third cousin, and he felt lust combined with territorial ambition, as he was obliged to look upward in order to lock eyes with her. Eleanor was breathtakingly beautiful, with auburn tresses cascading down the back of her bridal gown. She was also blessed with a slim figure, while Henry was stocky, ruddy-faced, red-haired, athletic and vigorous in appearance, in stark contrast to Eleanor's former first husband. Seen from a personal and territorial perspective, it was a match made in heaven. Between them, Eleanor and Henry would rule over a massive swathe of territories that ran, unbroken, from the borders with Flanders to the east to the Atlantic shores in the west. Their combined lands of Normandy, Anjou, Maine, Aquitaine and Poitou would command all the channel ports except those in Brittany. They would also stretch south all the way to the Vexin, the border country with the Île-de-France, over which Louis VII reigned with covetous eyes on the territorial riches of his northern neighbours. But from a religious and moral point of view, the devil was behind this union. Henry, at only 19, was already a dedicated whoremaster to whom no woman was forbidden. He had a passion for hunting, fighting and carousing, and had sired several bastards. His temper was unpredictable and violent, and he did not take kindly to having his desires thwarted. But Eleanor, allegedly, was more than a match for him in her determination to get her own way. She had been raised in the court of Poitiers, where the much-vaunted courtly love was a polite euphemism for promiscuity at a noble level. She had proved to be willful, headstrong, resentful of parental restraint, and impatient to experience more than a modest region southwest of the Loire could offer by way of diversion. Almost as an act of rebellion, she had consented to be married, at the tender age of 15, to the second son of Louis the Fat of France, who, in a short space of time, had become Louis VII. He had been destined for the church until his older brother, the heir apparent Philip, had died, but Louis lived his subsequent years as if already ordained, with celibacy high on his personal agenda. Little wonder that the affections of his libidinous queen were apt to wander, but it was not so much the fact that she strayed from her marital vows that scandalised the French court, as the identities of those with whom she allegedly transgressed. Most notably, and most recently, ugly rumours had been circulating of an incestuous affair between Eleanor and her own uncle, Raymond of Poitiers, Prince of Antioch, during the ill-fated Second Crusade that Louis and Eleanor had embarked upon in an attempt to recapture Jerusalem from the Turks. Eleanor's strident protests at being forcibly removed from Antioch by her husband in order to proceed towards Jerusalem only added fuel to the fire of prurient speculation, but it was a matter of note that Eleanor was by then campaigning for the dissolution of her marriage to Louis on the grounds of consanguinity, given that they were fourth cousins. The consanguinity issue had not, however, dissuaded Eleanor from marriage to Henry Plantagenet, to whom she was even more closely related. Of greater concern to Louis, had been the failure of Eleanor to produce any male heirs to continue the Capetian dynasty into another generation. Instead, they had only two daughters, Marie and Alix. Louis may also have been embarrassed by Eleanor's growing reputation for gracing noble beds other than his, and in March of that year he had consented to the annulment. Eleanor had been once again free to rule her inherited lands of Aquitaine and Poitou without husbandly interference. She was also free to remarry, and the speed with which she had become the far-from-blushing bride on this warm and sunny day in May had also set tongues wagging. Henry had first laid eyes on Eleanor the previous year, in the French palace located in the Ile de la Cité, when successfully persuading Louis to recognise him as Duke of Normandy in succession to his father Geoffrey of Anjou, who had died shortly thereafter. Having seen her, he'd been unable to look away, and it was believed that Henry's subsequent disappearances without notice for weeks at a time were in order to hold illicit liaisons with Eleanor. There had clearly been some exchange of communications between the two that had led to the clandestine ceremony that was now taking place, one that would be almost guaranteed to launch a bloody war. For one thing, it was a huge and very public insult to Louis of France. Perhaps more importantly, it created a massive power block to Louis's north, and seemed destined to extinguish any succession rights of Louis's daughters, Marie and Alix, to Aquitaine. All it would take would be the birth of a male heir to Henry and Eleanor, and the odds were very much in favour of that, given the sensual proclivities of the bride and groom. Little wonder that there were no invited guests, no proud proclamations of the impending nuptials, and virtually no one in attendance as the marriage vows were being exchanged. Not even Henry's mother was there, the redoubtable Matilda, through whom Henry was confidently and impatiently expecting to inherit the crown of England, although even that claim was bitterly disputed. For the past 17 years, since the death of his grandfather Henry in 1135, Henry's mother Matilda had been locked in a never-ending, and occasionally bloody, internecine contest with her cousin Stephen of Blois, over which of them had the right to the crown of England. Matilda, generally referred to as Maud, was the only surviving child of the deceased King Henry, and Stephen was his nephew, who had for a brief while been proclaimed by Henry as his heir. Barons on both sides of the Channel had been dragged into the conflict, until it had degenerated into a stalemate, and they had begun warring with each other. Maud had implied to the world that she had become exhausted and dispirited by her lack of success. Following the death of her husband, Geoffrey of Anjou, she had retired to a priory on the outskirts of Caen, Normandy's traditional capital, leaving her son Henry to fight on, carrying the Angevin hopes on his battle banners. While Henry was fuming in the wings, plotting how to wrest the crown of England from an increasingly unpopular King Stephen, the last thing he needed was an attack from the south by an outraged Louis of France. This was also the last thing desired by the grey-haired man, now in his 51st year, who was guarding the entrance doors to the cathedral, along with three of his men, ensuring that no one but those who had an unarguable right to be there could witness the ceremony. He was Richard, Earl of Chalfont, Henry's captain of the Royal Guard, and one of the few allowed sufficiently close to Henry to know what he was likely to do next. Not that Richard had any great regard for the man he had been all but forced to follow, with his evil temper and a stubborn recklessness that was likely to get them both killed. Richard had originally been seduced into siding with Stephen, when he'd learned that his mother Emma had been Stephen's illegitimate half-sister, and that therefore Stephen was his uncle. Richard had been feeling particularly vulnerable at that time, having been dismissed from service at the Westminster Palace of the deceased King Henry by his own father, then captain of the palace guard, following Richard's perceived incompetence in allowing his older sister Eleanor to be seduced by a romantic adventurer from the Vexin estate of Evreux. The outcome of the brief affair had been the birth of twin sons, Alain and William, whom Eleanor had been forced to abandon. The boys had been confined to an orphanage in Norfolk and had never met their father. In return for throwing in his lot with Stephen, Richard had been granted the estate of Chalfont, along with the earldom and the plump widow Agnes, both of which came with it. Then, conversely, his own family's immediate interests had dragged him into Maud's camp when she and his sister Eleanor, who was employed as Maud's senior lady and companion, had been trapped inside Oxford Castle when it was besieged by Stephen's troops. Richard had staged a daring and successful escape operation, which made him a traitor to Stephen's cause. He had then taken what seemed like an easy option at the time, namely an invitation by Maud to travel to Normandy in order to keep a watchful eye on the teenage Henry, who seemed fated to die by his own recklessness unless suitably restrained. Although elevated to his current status by a grudgingly grateful but definitely needful Henry, Richard was now stuck between two hard choices: desert Henry and scurry furtively back to England, risking a traitor's death at Stephen's hands, or remain where he was and take the verbal abuse and perpetual ingratitude from the arrogant and ambitious prince, who was standing in front of the altar with the expression of someone who had just been handed the moon and the stars. Following the ceremony, Henry and Eleanor were escorted back to the castle at Poitiers, where they intended to reside temporarily, while Henry decided how best to pursue his ambition to remove Stephen from the throne of England. This in itself created problems for Richard to deal with, since the ancient fortress that brought back such happy childhood memories for Eleanor was seething with resentment and discontent from querulous locals. They were too used to governing themselves in the almost permanent absence of any feudal overlord, and they were not about to be deprived of their virtual self-rule by a man barely out of his teens, who was crude, aggressive, seemingly uncultured and foreign, even if he had succeeded in bedding their own senior lady. In the opinion of many, Eleanor could have, and once had, done better for herself. Louis of France responded to the insult by forming a coalition to thwart Henry's territorial ambitions. As part of this process, he persuaded King Stephen of England, along with his son and declared heir Eustace, to stir up trouble for Henry in his own land, while the Counts of Champagne and Perche were ordered to harass Henry Plantagenet on his Normandy borders. Stephen's contribution was to lay siege to Wallingford Castle, a strategic fortress overlooking one of the few fordable crossings of the Thames just west of London. It had been held by Henry's forces for many years, and it was key to his English ambitions. It was also worryingly close to Richard's estate in Buckinghamshire, and he was only too eager to obey Henry's next command, once Louis's own failing health forced him to withdraw from his threatened campaign against Aquitaine, and the smattering of local uprisings fizzled out. Henry ordered all his available troops, including a worrying number of mercenaries, to cross the Channel under his command and lift the siege. Richard was informed that he was to accompany Henry, both to protect his person and to cast an experienced eye over Stephen's troops surrounding Wallingford. He was also granted grudging permission to visit his own estate on his way to Wallingford from Portsmouth when the invading force landed. "I was wondering if you would ever return," Agnes greeted Richard starchily as she welcomed him home with an eager hug that belied her critical words. "King Stephen has been expecting Henry to invade, and I have continued to attend court in order to learn what I could to your advantage, which means mine as well, I suppose." "And what have you learned?" Richard inquired as he led her back into the manor house, from which the aroma of newly baked bread was proving irresistible. "I'll eat while you tell me what you can. Has Stephen been calling for my head?" "He can barely call for silence these days," Agnes advised him, "given the riotous clamour that surrounds him, with barons in both his ears offering him competing advice." The court has degenerated into a shambles, such that no one seems to recall that my husband is known to be fighting for Henry of Anjou, except the ones who let it be known that, when you invade, they wish to join your side, in order to bring the uncertainty to an end. You should also know that Stephen has lost the support of the church, and that Archbishop Theobald of Canterbury refused to crown Stephen's son Eustace as the next King of England, before he fled to Flanders for his own safety. Stephen and Theobald were reconciled only recently, but Theobald continues to cast public doubt on Stephen's claim to the throne. Most of the clerical offices are hanging vacant, and the only bishop who seems to enjoy Stephen's favour is his own brother, Henry, Bishop of Winchester.
"I can hardly relieve the siege of Wallingford with bell, book and candle," Richard sneered, as he ripped a large chunk from a loaf of bread that had just been delivered to the table, then muttered a curse as it burned his fingers. Agnes frowned.
"You will give yourself a gripe if you eat that bread quickly when it has only just left the oven," she admonished him. "And I can only hope that your sexual needs are not so urgent, since it has been a long while and my ageing bones object to vigorous overuse. But it is not just the clergy who grow restless under Stephen."
"Who else?"
"I was approached privily by your old master Hugh Bigod, who first of all cursed your memory as a deserter from Stephen's cause, then asked that he be called upon should Henry decide to put his sword arm where his mouth has been these past few years. He claimed also to be speaking for Ranulf of Chester, who I personally would not trust to lie straight in bed. However, it seems that they would welcome the chance to pay homage to King Henry in due course."
"You are very fortunate to have been able to attend court without being seized and imprisoned," Richard reminded her, secretly impressed by both her courage and her acumen. "I have no doubt that if he got his hands on me, King Stephen would have me hung from the palace walls as a warning to other traitors." Agnes leaned down and kissed the top of his head.
"I had no other calls on my time, and I was obviously lacking company and diversion during your lengthy absence. I also wished to learn if you would be in any immediate danger were you to return. But as I already advised you, it would seem that the king needs all the friends he can collect around him these days, and he is much distracted. I doubt that he even remembers that you and I are married." Richard sighed.
"Unfortunately, Duke Henry seems to suffer from the same malady. He is so obsessed with having me by his side while he pursues his dream of conquering England that he forgets that I have a wife and estate of my own back here."
"But you are not by his side now, so where is he?"
"He is at the old Royal Hunting Lodge at Stockbridge, which is only one day's ride from where we landed and 2 days' ride from here. It is also close to the Treasury at Winchester. We may lay siege to that first, depending on what I can advise him regarding the size of Stephen's force at Wallingford."
"I can tell you that much," Agnes smiled, "since I have been riding there almost weekly, along with two of our armed attendants, Giles and Edmund. We estimate the besieging force to be several thousand strong." Richard rose from the table and hugged Agnes tightly to him.
"What a wife for a fighting man such as I to be blessed with. What would I do without you?"
"It is what you intend to do with me that concerns me at this moment," she smiled up at him enticingly. "But mind what I said about the frailty of my bones." 2. As Richard had himself admitted to the main hall of the hunting lodge at Stockbridge, Henry was deep in a murmured conversation with a man whose face was somehow familiar to Richard, but whom he felt sure he had never met. Henry looked away briefly from the conversation to welcome Richard back gruffly, adding,
"How fares your wife?"
"Middling well, thank you," Richard replied. "You owe her a considerable debt of thanks. Not only has she been keeping a watchful eye on Stephen's forces surrounding Wallingford, but she has been attending court, at considerable risk to herself,
and was able to advise me that several of the leading barons are waiting to throw in their lot with you. She made mention in particular of Ranulph of Chester." The visitor made a derisive noise and turned in order to spit into the rushes. Henry grinned and effected the introductions. "You really did make a very poor diplomat before you finally realised what you'd do best. Allow me to introduce Robert de Beaumont, Earl of Leicester, who has also offered me his considerable armed force in order to topple Stephen from his usurped throne." Robert smiled coldly as he addressed Richard. "You were at one time in league with my brother Valeron, before you both changed sides. As for Ranulph, he is a treacherous bastard who seized my estates in Dorset and handed them to Robert of Gloucester. But following Robert's death, I got them back by sheer force of arms, and in addition I took Ranulph's fortress at Mount Sorrel. We have been waging war on each other for the past 3 years, and now the slimy bastard seeks peace terms with Henry, after supporting the usurper for many years." Now Richard realised why the face was so familiar, even though this was his first glimpse of it. The two brothers were almost identical in appearance, and he recalled his last encounter with Valeron. "I last saw your brother in Normandy, when he was attempting to wean me back to Stephen's cause. He was at that time planning on going on crusade. Did he do so?" "He did, and he survived, but unfortunately he became too close with Louis of France, to whom he is bound for his Vexin estate in Melun. To make matters worse, he has married a sister of de Montfort, which makes his loyalties doubly suspect. It has been left to me to preserve the family's honour and estates here in England." "What saw you of Stephen's force at Wallingford?" Henry interrupted grumpily. "Or did you leave that entirely to your wife as well?" "I sat for some time on a hill overlooking the castle on my first day's journey back here," Richard replied icily, "and I would estimate that there are at least 4,000 armed men surrounding it. No doubt they are busily engaged in pillaging the surrounding countryside while we dawdle here." "All the more reason to do as I suggest," Robert observed with a smirk. Henry nodded. "Perhaps, but let us see what Richard has to say." "He will not be leading your army," Robert reminded him sharply. "Indeed, he will not, but he will be guarding my person while you lead the attack. Richard is an experienced strategist, so tell him what you suggested to me." Robert adopted a condescending smile as he explained. "Stephen has unwisely loaded all his dice and thrown them at the one target which is perhaps impregnable. Wallingford can well withstand the siege for several more weeks by my calculations, and it is my advice, born of experience of years in the field, that we draw some of Stephen's force further west. When they are committed, we sneak back north, then pass quickly through my Midland estates and relieve the siege from the north, once Stephen's ranks there are greatly reduced." Richard considered this briefly. "My first thought is that you would need to travel very quickly in order to double back by such a circuitous route. You would also need provisions for a large army on the move." "I command all the estates north and east of Bristol, and we could proceed through several of them before turning south once more," de Beaumont replied gloatingly. "It's a fast road to London by that route, and it was a good harvest, so the barns are full. Given the time of year, the tracks should be frozen hard, so that we could anticipate making 20 miles a day." "So how do you propose to draw Stephen westward?" Richard asked. "Malmesbury. Stephen has been using it for some time as the base for his defence of the port of Bristol, and his men have incurred the wrath of its citizens by raiding the surrounding estates for provisions. They are in permanent discord with the abbot of the nearby abbey,
and I have no doubt that were we to lay siege to the town, half of those within its walls would be delighted to open its gates to us. Then, when Stephen marches west to reclaim it, we move swiftly north and circle round him, back to Wallingford. It will take us perhaps 2 weeks to march a sizeable party of armed men in a semicircle, such as you describe, Richard objected, whereas Stephen can head back east to reinforce the siege of Wallingford in a matter of days. Only if he knows what we are about, Robert grinned. It is my proposal that we retreat across the Avon, as if making for Wales, deceiving Stephen into believing that we intend to join up with Ranulph in Chester. Instead, we follow the north bank of the Avon until we pick up the track to Cirencester and head northeast. Cirencester remains loyal to me, because it knows what is good for it, and from there we skirt around the north side of Oxford. Then we shall be upon Wallingford in just over one more day. We would probably be passing by my own estate, if not actually through it, Richard advised them both with a look of alarm.
"Here's hoping that your wife keeps a fine table, then," said Henry. "If you have no better objection than that, I propose that we ready our troops to depart at daybreak tomorrow."
"Where are your men?" Richard asked Robert.
"Eating the locals out of house and home. There are several thousand of them imposed on every household in a 10-mile radius of here, and my commanders can round them up in a matter of hours. I shall set about that now, if I might be excused."
"Do you trust him?" Richard asked Henry, once the doors had closed behind Robert. Henry frowned.
"Do I have a choice?
But from what you tell me, there will be others riding to my support. Your wife is indeed to be commended, if she has been bending the leading barons to my cause. It is a great benefit in life to have the support of a loyal wife. Mine remains at home in Poitiers, but in her latest dispatch she gave me the glad tidings that she is with child."
"Congratulations," Richard smiled, since it seemed to be expected. "But I did not mean to convey the impression that my wife Agnes has been actively soliciting armed support for your cause. As I understand it, the barons in question approached her. There was also mention of Hugh Bigod of Norwich, who I served under in my former days. If that be correct, then we shall be able to secure most of East Anglia."
"We have yet to rescue Wallingford," Henry reminded him, "and before that we need to secure Malmesbury. Your task will be to ensure my safety, of course, so you will remain with me to the rear of any fighting. No heroic ventures of your own, is that understood? At your age, that would not be a wise action anyway."
"You place your personal safety in the hands of an old man?" Richard challenged. Henry nodded.
"An old man who knows how to select and command men, certainly. Now, go to your rest. We have an early start on the morrow."
It almost went to plan. Within a week they were outside the walls of Malmesbury and raiding local estates for the provisions they required in order to keep a modestly sized army fed and watered. The men glowered up at the defenders on the city walls and hurled the occasional missile over them to remind those trapped inside that they were under siege. As anticipated, Stephen pulled some of his forces from the ongoing siege of Wallingford and marched west. Then it began to snow heavily as Henry's force crossed the Avon and sat shouting abuse across the water at the new arrivals. It was obvious, even to someone with only a passing familiarity with warfare, that either army could have crossed the relatively shallow and narrow ford to engage the other, but preservation from the bitter cold took priority. On the third day, a messenger sent by Henry returned with the heartening news that Stephen was prepared to withdraw if Henry did. Since this allowed Henry to travel north into the now friendly territory of the Earl of Leicester, he regarded the offer as a generous one.
By the end of the week, he was commodiously installed inside Warwick Castle as the guest of Robert de Beaumont. This left open the issue of whether or not Stephen's forces...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?